Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Implications of Recent Data Sets for Current and Future Management of Lung Cancer. Today, we're going to review papers presented at the ESMO Congress, World Lung Meeting, and other recent key publications. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Suresh Ramalingam from the Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, and Dr. Greg Riley from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. So today, as we go through this program, just keep in mind, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents from the FDA and regimens. We ask you to consult the prescribing information for each product for approved indications. Here's where we're heading. We had a kind of interesting approval come out on lung cancer. I thought it was pretty interesting. I thought I'd run by you. And then each of the faculty is going to go through a bunch of data sets which we're going to chat about in presentations they're going to give. So Greg, it was interesting, just October 15th, just a couple weeks ago, we saw the approval of Tumor Treating Fields, of course, previously approved in GBM as well as mesothelioma. I'm curious what your thoughts are about it. You know, it's kind of controversial, the mechanism of action. I'm curious what your thoughts are about it. It is different. I like that. But the data, the phase three trial that was presented, I think it was at ASCO 2023, kind of was done on patients who kind of got the last generation of therapy. So they were, a lot of these people are getting second line IO as compared to first line that pretty much everybody, at least we think about. And it looked like the benefit was there, but it was mainly in the people who got IO, so maybe a little tricky to apply. I think everybody's already familiar with the local problems that can occur with TTF in terms of from the electrodes, and now you have a larger field to deal with. There was a study looking at brain mets, you know, maybe hearkening back to what we saw with GBM that seemed to be positive when you combined with best supportive care. Right now there's a frontline trial. I think this is really what everybody wants to see, looking at combining it with IO and chemotherapy. So Greg, it's always interesting to ask people what they think about whether it works or how it works and whether or not it's ready for prime time now or ever. Sometimes you hear a little skepticism, but I like the fact that at least it's different. But anyhow, any thoughts, Greg?
Yeah, no, I'm with you on the different mechanism of action, because I think the different mechanisms of action brings to us the possibility of combining with stuff that we understand. And I think we have to understand this one a bit more. Clearly, the data are provocative. You know, it's not every day that we see an overall survival improvement from a randomized clinical trial. So we have to sit up and pay attention to that. And the efficacy signal we've seen from the initial trial in the second line setting, really, you know, and now we're doing just like we always do in lung cancer. We see some efficacy in the second line. Now we bring it into the front line in a cleaner patient population. So I think looking forward to the results of this LUNAR 2 trial to really bring it into prime time.
Suresh, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, Neil, I think the brain metastasis study that you showed was a good example where there was improvement in PFS, brain intracranial progression, but it did not translate into overall survival effect. So how this approach will provide benefit in systemic sites beyond the local area where patients are getting the treating field and how that influences the overall outcome, I think is something that we need to understand better in lung cancer.
So we're going to move on now and get into our first presentation by Dr. Ramalingam. We're already starting to get cases in the chat room. So far, they're targeted, so I'm going to hold off on that. But chat room, come on, give me some cases here and some questions as we go along. But Suresh, I'm going to turn it over to you. You're going to talk about some of the key papers that have come out, particularly from ESMO, but also World Lung in non-targeted therapy.
Sure. Thank you, Neil. What I will cover are some key abstracts from ESMO and World Conference that covered these topics. Obviously, the neoadjuvant and adjuvant immunotherapy area is where a lot of action is happening, and we see a lot of reports coming out. So I'll give a brief summary of the three key perioperative trials, and then I'll talk about some advanced stage studies that add to our knowledge. Starting with perioperative therapy, This is the KEYNOTE 671 trial. People are very familiar with this, where resectable patients get chemo plus pembro versus chemo alone. They get surgery, and then they go on to receive on the pembro arm 1 year of pembro. And the control group, they just receive placebo. And we know that this study improved event-free survival. We know that it improved overall survival. And the question now boils down to, what is the added value of using that 1 year of post-operative therapy? And all the reports that I'm going to show you try to get at this issue, though none of them are able to provide a definitive answer. So here is the KEYNOTE 671 study. If you look at the overall survival results, just about all groups of patients appear to benefit from receiving pembrolizumab. And on your right, on the Kaplan-Meier curve for overall survival, what you see here is, in this analysis, patients who completed surgery and went on to receive adjuvant pembro or placebo, the outcomes are better for patients who received pembro versus placebo. But the flaw or the fallacy of this analysis is shown by the fact that even in the placebo group, patients who go on to receive placebo in the adjuvant setting do better than patients who don't receive any adjuvant therapy. So whether this benefit you're seeing is more a spillover from previous therapy that they received before surgery, or whether it's selection bias because only the patients who go through and do well go on to receive adjuvant, is the big question here. And you will also see another interesting report that was reported, where they looked at amount of residual tumor after the patients had received chemo plus pembro, and that's what is called RVT, or residual viable tumor. And if you look at the percentage of viability, the lower the percentage of viable cells, the better the outcome is. And in fact, on your right, you see for patients who have a lot of residual tumor, there was no difference between continuation of pembro versus placebo. So it gives us some, it goes against the thought that some have proposed where if you have persistent disease, maybe you should give more immunotherapy. The next study I want to talk about is the CheckMate trials. We know there were two trials, CheckMate 77 and CheckMate 816. In CheckMate 77, patients received neoadjuvant chemo Nivo and then went on to receive adjuvant Nivo compared to placebo. And CheckMate 816, they just received chemo plus Nivo as preoperative therapy without any postoperative. So in the CheckMate 772, you see event-free survival was substantially improved for the chemo Nivo group. The hazard ratio is quite robust at 0.59. This was an update at the ESMO Congress. There was another study presented by Dr. Patrick Ford that combined the patients in 816 and 77. This was a patient-level analysis. They looked at patients who were able to go on and receive, after surgery, at least one dose of adjuvant Nivo. And they made the case that for patients who got that post-op Nivo, the outcomes were better than patients in the 816 study that just received pre-op chemo Nivo and did not receive anything. And the hazard ratio here was 0.61. Again, whether this is this an effect of getting Nivo after surgery, or is it just a carryover effect, is still a question. The DERVA study, which is the AGN, also very similar study design. Dr. Haymack reported this in the New England Journal. There was an update presented. And in this study, the update shows that event-free survival is substantially improved. The overall survival results are not mature at this time. This maturity is only about 35%. You start to see a separation of the tail of the curve. So that's promising for the study. They also reported that the event-free survival was better for patients who receive cisplatin as pre-op therapy compared to carboplatin, something that we've always believed in, cisplatin having a nose length advantage over carboplatin, particularly the curative setting. They noticed that the benefit was noted with durvalumab, regardless of whether the patient had a PATCR or not. And they also showed that patients who went on to receive the adjuvant durva did a little better. So all of these reports say that there may be something to the continuation of immunotherapy after they had gone through surgery, but there is no definitive trial in the space, and we will have to make these decisions on a case-by-case basis.
So some bunch of questions are coming into the chat room. First from Hassan, what do we know about the impact of perioperative IOs in the PD-1 negative patients, Greg?
you know, the PD-L1 negative patients, PD-L1 positive, PD-L1 negative, it's not something that has critically factored in. Clearly, when you look at subset analyses, PD-L1 positive patients do better. And so we select for those patients a little bit. But we also know that at PD-L1 negative patients, as long as they're EGFR and ALK wild type, those patients should receive neoadjuvant chemo-IO.
Suresh, another question. This is from Mayer. When, if ever, do you recommend postoperative radiation therapy in patients with residual disease?
Unless they have MRD-positive disease these days, Neil, we don't routinely do postoperative radiation therapy. The question of whether if patients have extensive N2 disease, should you radiate, was addressed in a clinical trial, the lung art study that failed to show benefit. So at this point, the role of post-op radiation is limited.
So a little outside the what we're talking about, but I can't resist asking Greg a question. Another question from Hassan about a 45-year-old man who has stage 3 adenocarcinoma, but a single brain met.
You know, these cases are always challenging. There's a sort of like they're stage 3 except, or they're stage 4, but there's only 3A disease. So, you know, I think these are tough. I generally will approach them as stage 4 for my initial approach. And so, you know, when a patient presents with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer with a brain met, I'll typically treat the brain met unless they have EGFR or ALK. And then I would treat the rest of the body with systemic therapy. But since they have such modest burden of disease, this is a patient I might explore consolidative radiotherapy down the road. Now, there is a case to be made for surgery if a patient doesn't have N2 disease, but if they have N2 disease, I'd really steer clear of surgery in these cases.
Suresh, any thoughts about that question?
I agree with Greg. I think in the presence of mediastinal nodes, doing what you would do for molecular testing and so forth to understand what is the right therapy for this patient and starting with systemic therapy would be my choice as well.
So I think one of the most interesting questions we talk about on Saturday in Orlando, I'd like to throw out to both of you again. Seems like a pretty simple question, but maybe the answer is not so simple. Greg, when do you use neoadjuvant chemo IO? When do you let the patient go to surgery?
You know, pretty much whenever I meet a patient who could get neoadjuvant chemo IO, I do it. I think there's a lot of times where the surgeons have met the patient first and they feel like the patient is just really teed up for surgery and they go straight to it. But if I've met a patient who has, you know, stage 2, stage 3 lung cancer, I'm almost always going to recommend neoadjuvant chemo IO.
So, Greg, a question here that I think maybe I need to come back to you for. Actually, it's been a while since I chatted with you. We had so much stuff to talk about now. In the, quote, old days, there wasn't as much, but Dilip wants to know, could you please settle the issue of cis and carbo? Quote, the younger generation is not cognizant of the point you made.
I don't know if there's ever a day where we'll stop arguing about cis or carbo. But I think in the perioperative setting, I am a fan of cisplatin-based regimens. I think that if we can get cisplatin-based regimens in, we should. Now, we know that cisplatin-based regimens have less myelosuppression compared to carboplatin-based regimens, and so that's definitely something also to pay attention to. That said, it's not a hill I'm going to die on, and if a doc thinks carbo is better for their patient, I'm usually okay with it.
Any thoughts, Suresh? I mean, I think we're talking about metastatic disease here. I think, you know, adjuvant is a different story. But in metastatic disease, I know, Greg, are you still a cis person in metastatic disease, Greg?
I do, and particularly in the FLAURA2 era where I'm given osimertinib plus chemotherapy sometimes.
Really?
I'm often using cisplatin in that setting.
Interesting. Well, you know, we like to do these things where we ask 20 investigators, and I know in the past we asked 20 investigators. Not too many gave that answer. Suresh, again, metastatic disease, cis or carbo?
I tend to go with carboplatin for my metastatic patients. I've gotten comfortable using carbopemetrexed, easy to give patients and not have to worry about toxicities.
All right, well, let's get into metastatic disease. And actually, I think one of the more interesting and provocative presentations in oncology in general this year, let alone lung cancer. Suresh?
Absolutely. Yeah. So what, Neil, you're referring to is a first-line immunotherapy study that we just saw. We all know that there are three FDA-approved agents for high PD-L1 positive patients, pembro, atezo, and cemiplimab. Now, what I'm going to talk about is a new antibody that targets VEGF and PD-1 at the same time, and this is called ivonescimab. This trial was done in China, enrolled patients with metastatic disease who were PD-L1 positive, greater than or equal to 1%, and it was a head-to-head comparison between ivonescimab and pembrolizumab. 400 patients, very impressive results. This is PFS. Hazard ratio was 0.51. It's 6 months versus 11 months. And the overall survival was also favorable. When you look at PD-L1 expression in the low group, high group, squamous, non-squamous, in every group, ivonescimab showed improvement in progression-free survival. Now, the side effects were along expected lines. You would expect VEGF-related side effects that on top of PD-1 related side effects. Nothing unexpected in that realm. So overall, this trial establishes potentially this drug as an effective frontline strategy. Now, this was done in China. We have to see how this fares in Western patient population. So we'll wait to hear some of the results of some of the studies that have been initiated recently that will give us additional information. But clearly, this one study made everybody sit up when it comes to metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. This is the PIONEER study looking at a number of interesting options, combination approaches with immunotherapy, monalizumab, oleclumab, ceralasertib, are all agents that target various pathways related to the immune system or otherwise. Savolitinib targets MET. And that study shows the kind of approaches that the field is taking. At this point, there is nothing to take home from that study. What I do want to spend a minute on is looking at antibody-drug conjugate datopotamab. This targets TROP2. This is a salvage therapy trial in this non-small cell lung cancer patient population. No prior docetaxel. Patients were randomized to Dato-DXd versus docetaxel. And dual endpoints, PFS and overall survival. We saw an update of this study at the World Conference. For the entire group, there was no significant difference in overall survival. However, when they looked specifically at non-squamous, there is an improvement in overall survival, whereas in squamous patients, the hazard ratio was detrimental. So this appears to be effective, particularly in the non-squamous population, better than docetaxel. We've all been looking for what's better than docetaxel for a long time. So this result assumes significance. At the toxicity side, there are certainly some additional toxicities to contend with. Stomatitis, nausea were seen more frequently with datopotamab compared to docetaxel. Majority of them were grade 1 or 2, but certainly grade 3 stomatitis was seen in approximately 7% of the patients. Some patients do develop the pneumonitis, which we've seen with this payload, deruxtecan, so that's something for people to be aware of. Switching gears, finishing up, there are some biomarker efforts ongoing. It's a little too early to take these observations to home, but certainly looking at protein expression both within the cell and the membrane appears to have a potential predictive benefit that needs to be confirmed in prospective trials.
So, of course, I want to know what both of you think about ivonescimab on whether or not if you had it available, you'd be willing to use it. A phase 3 trial, of course, it was done in Asia. And also, I guess, Greg, we don't really know whether or not we would have seen the same thing with IO plus Bev. You were mentioning when we chatted something I had never heard before, that Asian patients are more sensitive to Bev. So anyhow, any thoughts in general about this, Greg?
Yeah, I look forward to seeing some data from Western patients. I think, you know, the concept of VEGF plus IO is a good one. And that's also being studied in the Pragmatica lung trial in the second line setting. So this idea of combining VEGF and IO is a really good one. And whether this particular bispecific antibody has some magic associated with it, I think we really need some more data to decide that.
Suresh, any thoughts?
I agree with Greg. This is very interesting. And if these results hold up in the Western population, this will be the first one to trump PD-1 blockade that we've seen in nearly 8 or 9 years since these agents have been used routinely in lung cancer.
So, Greg, a question kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of neoadjuvant IO, but I have to ask you about this because this has something in here I'd actually look up. 80-year-old patient with adenocarcinoma, at least stage 3 disease, target workup pending. Interestingly, she was reported to have possible IgG4 disease on pathology. Do you use immunotherapy in patients with IgG4 disease, which is, as far as at least looking it up here, maybe everybody else knows about it, but anyhow, for those who don't, pulmonary immunoglobulin G4-related disease, rare autoimmune disorder that occurs when plasma cells with IgG4 infiltrate the lungs. Ever heard of it, Greg? And would you give an IO in there?
It's some vague clicking sounds of memory of what that might be, but I can't say that. I guess my first response would be I would try to hold off on using immunotherapy for a patient like this. You know, whenever I have autoimmune disorders where I'm thinking about, what troubles could arise, I typically will hold off on combining it in the first line setting. I might use it as a single agent in the second line setting in that case.
I mean, maybe if the patient had a very high PD-1 level, it'd be even more challenging. Suresh, any thoughts? Have you heard about this, or did she
start? No.
This is Rosanna. This is Rosanna in the chat room.
Well, I learned something new today. I have not heard about this.
We all learned something new. I love it. All right. So, Greg, any thoughts about Dato? You know, I had the histology thing's kind of interesting. Do you think it's going to get approved? How tolerable is it? We heard about mucositis, et cetera. Where do you think it's heading?
I think it's got a shot at approval. I guess I have to admit to being really frustrated that this is something that we're only picking up on these histology differences so late in the game. You know, to run a big randomized phase 3 trial without any sense of biomarker, even histology as a biomarker, tells us we might be running a little too fast with some of these big randomized phase 3 trials.
So, Suresh, you know, it's frustrating. And I think docetaxel is like the cure ambucil is in CL. Everybody was trying to beat it but it's been hard to beat second line in lung cancer as much as people don't like using it. Any thoughts about Dato? If it were available, would you use it in non-squamous patients?
I think it would be used for selective patients. Once again, this is going to boil down to individualizing the toxicity benefit. The clinical benefit balancing against the toxicity that you see will have to be an individualized decision. But I do think that there are subsets of patients with lung cancer where you're looking for that extra bang that you may be able to use this.
And so Sohail in the chat room reminds me, we're talking about docetaxel and ramucirumab, or potentially with ramucirumab. So, Greg, we have like our research to practice pool on how long it'll take before somebody in a webinar is going to bring up cell-free DNA, but Hassan just brought it up. You're talking both in the localized and metastatic setting. We see it being used all over oncology. Is it here in lung cancer or going to be here?
You know, I think there's a lot of data around use of cfDNA, but I have to admit the only place where I really know to use it is upfront in that patient where, you know, you don't have enough material or you're not sure you're going to get the results quickly enough from the initial evaluation. We sometimes use it in the setting of resistance to targeted therapies, looking for MET amplification and that sort of thing. So there's a potential role for it there. I think the most exciting place for it is in the minimal residual disease setting, but we don't have as much data to guide us about how we respond to it, and that's a frustrating thing. But I definitely think there's going to be some hot stuff there. We're not there yet.
Greg, what do you think about the TROP2 assay? Suresh, you know, commented on that, but when I saw it, I was kind of excited because a lot of these ADCs, not just in lung, but breast, you know, they go, everybody has TROP2, and theoretically, you're looking for a target. A lot of these ADCs, you have a target, and yet you give it to everybody. Any sense whether this new membrane-targeted assay is going to give us more clarity, Greg?
It's good data from the first look at it, but I think incorporating into regular everyday practice is going to be really challenging, I have to admit. And I think we need biomarkers. I'm not sure this is the one.
So, Suresh, always get all excited about small cell. Haven't had much to talk about since the IOs came out first line. Now we got some good stuff to talk about. Let's hear about it.
Sounds good. I'll talk about a couple of studies that we heard results of recently. Now, everyone is by now familiar with the Adriatic study that was presented at ASCO, where patients with limited stage disease received durvalumab versus placebo after they had completed the initial therapy. And in this study, we saw improvement in PFS, we saw improvement in overall survival, hazard ratio was approximately 0.75. At the ESMO Congress, we heard some data about the impact of patients receiving prophylactic cranial irradiation. In this study, a good number of patients came in having received PCI, and some had not. And when we look at the outcomes for patients who received PCI versus those who did not, the hazard ratio still favored the use of durvalumab. It was about 0.75 in the PCI received group and 0.71 in the patients who had not received PCI. So this basically allows us in clinical practice, if you administer PCI in the limited stage disease after chemo RT, you can move forward and still deliver durvalumab to these patients and achieve clinical benefit. The other exciting development this year is the FDA approval of tarlatamab. It's a bispecific antibody that targets DLL3 and CD3. And in small cell lung cancer, the approval is based on a single phase two kind of study. This is a study design. We saw some updated results at the World Conference. The 10 milligram dose given days 1 and 8, and then subsequently done every 3 weeks. The response rate with tarlatamab was 40%. Median PFS is 4.3 months, and the median overall survival is about 15 months. And patients maintained their response, about 10 months median duration of response. So this is the data. The side effects that one needs to be aware of mainly is the cytokine release syndrome. This is why for the first two administrations, you want to keep them in a monitored setting, presumably very likely in the hospital or the observation units. About 50% of the patients develop it. The overall incidence, majority of them are grade 1 or 2. When you administer the day 8 dose, the number of people who develop it goes down, and it's typically in cycle 1. You don't see it cycle 2 and beyond. So this is definitely a good option for patients who have progressed on prior platinum-based therapy in patients with small cell lung cancer. There are some additional novel agents that are making their way. MK-6070 is a DLL3 targeting, very specific, very similar to what we saw with tarlatamab. Early response rates look promising, 36%. Also showed intracranial activity at 25% brain mets, brain response. So something to keep your eye out for. Another group of drugs that has people excited about is an ADC. There are multiple ADCs that target this protein called B7-H3. This one that was reported at the World Conference is called ifinatamab. It has shown in a small group of patients a response rate of 55% and a median PFS of 5.5 months, also showed intracranial activity. And the side effects are nausea, anorexia, fatigue. So this seems to be a promising group of agents. We're going to hear more from these in the upcoming months, 2 years. And I hope this becomes available to our patients if this activity that we see in this trial holds up in subsequent cohorts of patients. So I'll stop there, Neil.
So, Greg, are you a PCI person in small cell or limited stage?
I am not a PCI person. I think that the close monitoring with MRIs is superior in my head to giving everybody PCI.
And just curious what your thoughts are about this antibody drug conjugate. It looks like pretty effective there. Would you like to have it available? And what's going to come first? That, I mean, putting aside whatever the regulatory issues are, that or tarlatamab?
You know, I think, you know, the administration risks or challenges of tarlatamab are not to be understated. You know, having to admit the patient to the hospital and manage them that way is it's a big deal. So if these antibody drug conjugates have the efficacies that we're seeing today, I think there's real potential.
Any thoughts, Suresh? And, you know, when I first heard about tarlatamab, I was like, wow, they're going to give a CD3 bispecific, because, of course, we've been talking about it in myeloma and lymphoma for a while. And I envision, you know, a patient with COPD and heart disease and et cetera, are getting CRS. How's that playing out so far, Suresh?
We certainly see CRS. That's why making sure you're administering the drug in a setting where people are comfortable managing this toxicity is important. And we see a lot of patients referred into us at the cancer center from our community colleagues because they're still learning how to do this. And in the interim, they want their patients to get this drug.
So let's hear about a couple of cases briefly from Suresh. We heard questions about PD-1 negative patients, and here's a 77-year-old lady with early stage disease. What happened with her, Suresh?
Yeah, she presented with a fairly sizable 4-centimeter mass with some mediastinal adenopathy, specifically one node in the AP window. We decided to give her 3 cycles of chemo plus Nevo per the CheckMate 816 study. And she tolerated well, and last week we got the PET scan, and she had a dramatic response to treatment. Her tumor has gone down, SUV went down from 29 to 3, the lymph node is resolved, so she looks ready for surgery, which will happen in a couple of weeks, and we look forward to seeing the pathology report after that. So a good success story, even though I was a little skeptical given that she was PD-L1 negative, how she was going to respond when I started.
So, Greg, if she turns out to have a path CR, is she done?
I think so. You know, the data really are suggestive from CheckMate 816 that people who have path CRs have really excellent outcomes, and there's nothing to tell me that adding a whole long course of extra Nevo is going to make a difference.
Let's hear about this small cell case of 59-year-old woman. I see she got LERB. I was going to ask you before, Suresh, there was a press release out there that LERB added to IO in the first-line setting as maintenance. We haven't seen the data yet, but do you think we're going to be doing that? And how do you think that's going to go in terms of tolerability?
The good news, Neil, is that in small cell, finally, we're seeing the wheels start to move. Lurbinectedin data will be eagerly awaited. If it shows a clinically meaningful benefit in addition to being statistically significant, I think people will see how best to integrate it into the clinic. So we want to use all options available to extend the life of our patients. And in this patient, lurbinectedin worked for a while, and then after 6 months, the patient developed progressive disease and then was treated with tarlatamab. And sure enough, the patient developed CRS after the first dose and then went on to receive a total of 2 cycles, unfortunately did not benefit. And this is the kind of patient for whom the ifinatamab data look very promising as part of a clinical trial. So I think having more agents now allows us to pick and select which patient should get which treatment and also which one should go before the other. The same case can be made for tarlatamab and lurbinectedin. Which one do you give first and second? So it's a good time, and we're going to learn a lot about these agents and how they can be optimally utilized in small cell in the upcoming months and years.
So I just noticed, Greg, actually, this lady, I guess, was treated on the outside and was 2022, got a chemo but didn't get an IO. Do you see would an IO be a consideration in her?
So I think we know that cis-ETOP radiation for limited stage disease, we would generally follow that up with IO as a standard maintenance step. Now, single agent IO hasn't shown us the efficacy we like in small cell. So I think I wouldn't make that a sort of standard part of the treatment here.
All right, let's move on and talk about targeted therapy. Of course, you can't talk about targeted therapy even in an hour, let alone a day now, of course. But we'll pick out a few things, particularly related to some recent developments. So, Greg, let's hear about some of these papers, particularly from ESMO and World Lung.
Great. You know, I think it's fun to think back to the old days, which maybe was a year and a half ago or so, where you had a patient where they had stage 4, you know, exon 19 deletion or L858R, EGFR mutant lung cancer, and that patient got osimertinib. It was a pretty clear answer, and there wasn't a long discussion about it. But really, when you think today, we actually have more options. And for that patient with a classical 19 deletion L858R, we have 3 real options up front. You can give single agent osimertinib, You give osimertinib plus chemotherapy, platinum pemetrexed, or you could get amivantamab plus lazertinib. And so when I'm looking in the EGFR world today, what I'm trying to figure out is how do I make this decision for my patient? How do I figure out what the best thing to recommend for them is? And so at the World Lung meeting we saw, or at, between World Lung and ESMO, we saw a few different presentations that I think can give us a hint. This is just a reminder of the FLAURA2 trial. And this trial enrolled patients with newly diagnosed EGFR mutant lung cancer and randomized them to either osimertinib or osimertinib plus chemotherapy. Relatively straightforward thing. They had the sort of primary post-hoc analysis they presented here was to look at tumor burden. And what they did is they divided tumor burden into number of sites of disease and said, did they have three or more, or did they have fewer than three? And when they looked at that, this is the top section of the slide here, patients on the left were those patients with a higher tumor burden, and you see the hazard ratio 0.57. And on the right is the patients who had a smaller burden of disease, and there you see the hazard ratio is 0.75. That makes a case, really, that patients who have a bigger tumor burden are going to benefit more from the combination of chemotherapy and osimertinib. Similarly, on the bottom panel, you see patients with CNS metastases, those patients who had brain mets, had a hazard ratio of 0.47, as compared on the right to those patients without brain metastases, those patients had a hazard ratio of 0.75. So again, we're seeing a greater benefit for those patients who have CNS metastases. And so that really suggests that bigger tumor burden, maybe that's the place to add in the chemo compared to just the osimertinib. A little bit more data, same point, liver metastases, hazard ratio 0.66, with or without, kind of the same. And bone metastases, we do see a little bit of that same flavor of things. On the bottom left, patients with bone metastases, hazard ratio 0.56. Without bone metastases, hazard ratio of 0.7. Again, adding to this idea that more cancer means this is the time to do a little bit more than just the single agent osimertinib. Of course, the other option in the first line setting is amivantamab plus lazertinib. This is a reminder of the Mariposa trial. This trial enrolled patients with newly diagnosed EGFR mutant lung cancer and randomized them to either amivantamab plus lazertinib or osimertinib, the standard of care at that time. And we saw a bunch of subset data. And so in particular, looking at intracranial PFS, you see that amivantamab plus lazertinib is clearly just as good as osimertinib. Time to treatment discontinuation, there's a bit of superiority for amivantamab plus lazertinib with a hazard ratio of 0.8 and a small p-value. Bottom left is the curve that I kind of like to think of as magical thinking, the PFS2 curve, because this is what's the PFS for the next line of therapy? So not the line of therapy dictated by the trial, but the next line. And you see in that situation, the amivantamab plus lazertinib led to a better second progression-free survival. And then finally, in the bottom right is overall survival analysis. Now, this isn't a mature overall survival analysis. This was dictated by, I think, a regulatory authority. What you see here is that there's really a hint that there's an overall survival benefit. You see a hazard ratio of 0.77. The p-value is 0.019. Now, for various statistical reasons, that's not a significant p-value. It had to be less than 0.0001 to be called significant. But those curves look pretty good, suggesting that there might be an overall survival advantage for amivantamab plus lazertinib compared to single-agent osimertinib. So now we move from the upfront section to what do we do when patients progress on osimertinib? Because that is, in our clinic today, one of the common scenarios. And so option one really is this trial. This trial looked at amivantamab plus chemotherapy compared to chemotherapy after osimertinib. And you see improvement in overall survival on the top right for amivantamab plus chemo versus chemo alone. Now, this is, again, sort of a funny ad hoc analysis of overall survival. And so the p of 0.039 is not a significant p-value. It had to be a p p-value of less than 0.0142, but nonetheless, again, a suggestive finding that we're going to see a benefit in overall survival at the end of the day. And then the time to treatment discontinuation was clearly superior for amivantamab plus chemo versus chemotherapy alone. Another option that people are hearing a little bit about in the post-osimertinib space is patritumab deruxtecan. This is an antibody-drug conjugate that binds to HER3. We've seen data for this in multiple second-line studies or third-line studies where patients received this drug in an unrandomized fashion, like this data that was recently published and presented, and this is a large group of patients who were second, third line treatment with patritumab deruxtecan. If you look specifically at patients who've had chemo and osimertinib, the response rate here is 28%, suggesting that this drug has potential value. We have been waiting for a further data, and we know that we got a press release last month from the Herthena Lung 02 trial. This schema has a bit of a mistake in it. So a trial looked at patients who had EGFR mutant disease who progressed after prior osimertinib and randomized those patients to either chemo or patritumab. So it's an either or rather than a combination. And what we see here is that the press release says that this is a positive PFS trial. And so we'll look forward to seeing those data coming up. And then I'd like to end the EGFR section with osimertinib in locally advanced lung cancer. We saw this data presented at ASCO and subsequently published showing that after chemo RT for stage 3 EGFR mutant lung cancer, osimertinib was superior to placebo. And on the bottom left, you see the PFS curve. And on the bottom right, you see the CNS progression-free survival. So again, as we expect with osimertinib, it really shows improvements in CNS progression-free survival. Now, when we all saw this data, one of the first thoughts was, gee whiz, that placebo arm drops off real fast. Are these patients really stage 3 or did they have stage 4 disease? And at the meetings recently, we saw data about PET scan utilization. And so if the group of patients had a PET scan, did they still have that big drop off? Turns out they did. This group of patients with stage 3 lung cancer really progressed pretty quickly post chemo RT. And so it really shows us the role of osimertinib in this patient population. Now, moving to the EGFR exon 20 insertion, that's that 1% of patients who have EGFR exon 20 insertions. We know that we have frontline data comparing chemo to chemo plus amivantamab. And this, at the World Lung Cancer, Jonathan Goldman presented some more data looking at subsets of the EGFR exon 20 insertion crowd of patients to see if there's any group of patients who maybe we shouldn't do the combination or had extra benefit. And really, we see pretty universal benefit, you know, in that on the top section, we have P53 mutations present on the left or not present on the right. Either way, hazard ratio is very good for progression-free survival. And then on the bottom panel, we look at the various different types of EGFR exon 20 insertions. Again, we see that amivantamab plus chemotherapy is superior in each of these groups. There's a new drug looking at EGFR exon 20 insertions. This is a small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor called zipalertinib. And this we saw a little bit of data presented at the upcoming meeting, at the prior meetings. And zipalertinib looks to be an active agent. And what you see here is the waterfall plot showing almost all the patients with some tumor shrinkage. And I think notably in the gold bars or the orange bars here are patients who've had prior amivantamab plus another exon 20 insertion drug. And the blue bars are all people who've had prior amivantamab. And in that patient population, you see a very good response rate, 40% overall, including a 50% response rate in people who've had amivantamab alone, as well as 25% in people who've had amivantamab and a prior EGFR TKI. So provocative data there.
So I wrote down here about 3,000 questions, but I'll just pick out a few. So Suresh, I was sort of flashing on the fact there was a TKI, I think actually approved in exon 20, I think it was called mobocertinib, that sort of disappeared. Everybody was kind of using it, I think, at least that at some point. How does this new agent ZipAlertNib compare to that? And is this something you'd like to have available, or you need more data?
I think there are a number of more safer, I would say, on a relative scale, TKIs in this space that are making their way, whether it's ZipAlertNib or some of the other drugs where we have seen some data. We've seen, for example, sunvozertinib is another drug where we've seen data on more patients. So I think it's good to have options. Mobocertinib failed to demonstrate superiority over chemotherapy in a frontline trial, and that's why it was withdrawn from the market. Now we have amivantamab as one drug, and we are looking for TKIs in this space.
So any thoughts about this agent ZipAlertNib, Greg? Again, you know, at least you had a TKI you could use a second line. Now I'm not sure they go in a trial. Any thoughts about whether or not this may end up being second line?
Yeah, I think this has got a real shot, and I think it'll be a useful agent. I would hope that we can see data moving it into the front line relatively soon. I like single agent targeted therapies. I'd rather avoid giving chemo if I didn't have to.
Yeah, I was going to get to that, but I'm not sure we're going to have time. But I just want to go back because this has so far been my favorite question from the chat room. This is from Emily. And usually when we talk about locally advanced and osimertinib, Suresh, I like to ask people, well, what other mutations would you like to give, or are you giving it? Are you giving it durvalumab to RET, or are you giving an ALK inhibitor? And I'm going to ask you that question, but I want to tag one to something I never even thought about, and it sounds like an actual patient Emily has. 66-year-old man, locally advanced stage 3C, adenocarcinoma. NGS says ERBB2 amplification. Let's say also maybe it could have shown a mutation, either one. Completes chemo radiation, and she's planning to consolidate with durvalumab, but wants to know whether or not you think TDXD would have a role. And I'll add to that, if it wasn't amplification and mutation, would that get you to think about holding off on durva or maybe adding afterwards TDXD?
It's an interesting situation, Neil. In lung cancer, amplification of HER2 has not translated into being a viable target. TDXD, I would say, would have very marginal effect. And therefore, using durva, which is the proven approach across patient populations of non-small cell lung cancer, to me would be a more reasonable approach. If the patient had a HER2 mutation, would a HER2 targeted drug help? I think that's an interesting question based on the LoRa that we could ask for all molecular alterations that have targeted therapies. And I think that's a question that we need to address. There are some ongoing studies that will hopefully answer this question.
Quick point of clarification back to Greg. Do you agree about this issue about if there's not a mutation, only amplification? We have a pan-tumor approval for IHC3+.
Yeah, so I think there is clear efficacy data for high overexpression, so 3+. The FDA approval was based on a relatively small number of patients with lung cancer, but it had a 50% response rate in that context. So this is something I don't do often, but in the later lines of therapy, if I find the patient has HER2 overexpression by IHC 3+, I'll definitely use it.
So before we move on, we could again spend the whole hour talking about. I think we did on Saturday, but just briefly, Suresh, would you like to give your thoughts about first line therapy of EGFR disease, mutant disease, and the first line therapy? You mentioned, or Greg went through three options. Of course, osimertinib alone seems very tempting because quality of life. It's an oral agent, lasts for a long time. Are there situations where we'll use one of the other combinations?
For patients who have bulky disease or CNS metastases, I am more inclined to discuss the role of chemo plus OC in those patients. I've not used amilazertinib in my clinic. If one were to choose that regimen, I think one, we should be aware of the infusion reaction, which is manageable. One should be aware of the need for anticoagulation, at least for the first 4 months. And of course, prophylactic skin care are going to be important. In my practice, for most patients, it's OC monotherapy. If you have bulky disease, CNS disease, it's chemo plus OC.
So we'll see whether sub-Q amivantamab at least ameliorates the infusion toxicity. Greg, what about, we've talked about EGFR for a long time, and particularly second line therapy. Some of these patients have potentially targetable lesions in the second line. Usually people aren't using IOs at all, or if not, very, very late. If patritumab were available, Greg, what would you be thinking about in terms of patients progressing with EGFR?
Yeah, I think it's going to be my go-to, really, in the second line post single agent osimertinib. And frankly, you know, if I have a patient who's gotten the Flora 2 regimen of chemo plus osimertinib, it's also going to be a kind of obvious next step. I think when you have these patients progress off of chemo plus osimertinib, then that amivantamab plus chemotherapy approval isn't quite as useful. So it's nice that it's just a single agent drug.
So, Suresh, I'm curious about your experience with patritumab and, of course, tolerability issues. You know, now that ADCs are coming in, a lot of people sort of view this as chemotherapy. And, of course, when you have the last name of DXD, we think about ILD. So what do we know about, what are your experiences in terms of efficacy, tolerability, and ILD with patritumab, Suresh?
I've been lucky with the drug. We've been part of the clinical trial from the early days, and I have a number of patients who went on to get, 10, 12 months of clinical benefit with patritumab. The ILD, you do see that occasionally, and, you manage it like we do with trastuzumab deruxtecan. Nausea, vomiting, and fatigue can be seen with patritumab. Those can all be managed. So I'm optimistic that this will be a valuable addition to the treatment of EGFR-mutated lung cancer patients.
Did I ever tell you one of my only oncology jokes is, what would you name an antibody to HER3? To HER3, Greg or Suresh? Trastuzumab? Hey, that's all I got. That's all I got. All right, let's talk a little bit about ALK. Everybody was blown away, I think, by the CROWN data with erlotinib. I'm really curious about NVL-655 and particularly whether how it might compare to lorlatinib, and particularly whether or not it's going to have the tolerability issues of lorlatinib. Greg, what do we know about this agent?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a hot drug, but still in the letters and numbers phase. So it's NVL-655. It's, it showed us this waterfall plot here on the left. And I think what's striking is, you know, the waterfall plot on the left is prior lorlatinib. So generally in the U.S., this is alectinib followed by lorlatinib, and then to this, or patients who've progressed early on lorlatinib. And so you see in the overall patient population of patients who've had prior lorlatinib, so 35% response rate, so very good. And then you find the patients who have mutations, which predicts that they're really still dependent on the ALK signal, you see that there's even better response rates. So it looks like a provocative new drug that hopefully we'll see some more data on. And in terms of more data, we see duration of response. And you see that if look at the green line are patients who are treated with recommended phase 2 dose, looking pretty good in terms of duration of response. Clearly early data, particularly when you think of the grand scale of CROWN data that says we're looking at years and years of therapy. This is early data, but it looks like it has some potential legs. And I'll move next.
Maybe just before you go on, I'm just kind of curious. So what do we know about tolerability? We have a couple questions in the chat room about how do you manage side effects, the CNS side effects. And docs in practice now know about the CROWN data as well. Suresh, what do we know in terms of tolerability here? Does it have these sort of lorlatinib personality, et cetera, changes?
It seems to be well-tolerated drug, Neil. I have not personally used it, have followed the data closely. One of my patients goes to MGH to get treated, and I hear from her on a regular basis, and the tolerability seems pretty good. So it may not have all the other issues that lorlatinib has, at least based on early experience.
Greg, have you ever used it? Any information about interesting that they respond after having prior lorlatinib, too. That's really amazing. Any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I do think it's going to be a good drug in terms of tolerability. Clearly, lorlatinib has been treated with a lot more patients, a lot more patients have been treated, so we've had a better chance to see this. But I think in terms of TRAC toxicity, the TRAC inhibition, that's one of the ways that we're seeing this toxicity develop, and there's less TRAC inhibition in the NVL drug.
That's great. So ROS1.
Yeah. So ROS1, we've had for a while both crizotinib and entrectinib as our first line approaches. Recently, we learned we had added in repotrectinib both as a first line drug and then as a second line drug. And lorlatinib has kind of played a role in here a little bit, though it hasn't been a clear role. What we know about repotrectinib on the left is it has real efficacy in various mutated versions of ROS1, so suggestive of value in the second line setting. And on the right, you see at the top panel, patients who've had no prior ROS1 TKI, they had good efficacy with repotrectinib. And even in the second line on the bottom, patients who've had prior crizotinib, prior entrectinib, repotrectinib can have a relatively clear role. So in that context now, we have another ROS1 drug, and this is zidesamtinib that we saw data for at ESMO. And again, we're seeing a group of patients who've had lots of prior drugs. And I think on the left is the purple group. They have had prior repotrectinib. So in that group of patients with prior repotrectinib, we're still seeing responses. And I think that's a pretty impressive thing. And if you look over at the repotrectinib naive group, who've still had a couple prior ROS1 TKIs, a lot of efficacy there, 44% for patients who've had prior lorlatinib. So it seems like a real possible drug. We look at the duration of response. The data are still very immature, but if you look over on the right there, that group of patients at the who've had one prior ROS TKI, i.e. crizotinib, who go on to zidesamtinib, it's a real long, nice duration of response with nobody progressing yet. So seems provocative, seems interesting. We look forward to seeing some more data on this one.
So Suresh, what's your current first-line therapy for ROS1, and what do you think about this new agent, zidesamtinib?
Yeah, I think until recently, entrectinib was my go-to drug for first-line. I have not used repotrectinib yet for considering the rarity of this patient population. I've not seen a patient. This one that Greg just mentioned seems promising. I think these patients unfortunately develop acquired resistance regardless of how long they benefit. So having options to treat them at the salvage setting is important.
So let's just briefly look at Greg has a couple of cases. This starts out here with the EGF19 deletion with a 74-year-old patient, and we'll just shoot right to the fact that she now has a progressive disease on osimertinib, gets a carbo-PEM and PEM maintenance, and now has more progression. At that point, Greg, what was her condition? How symptomatic was she, and what did you do?
Yeah, she was in relatively decent shape. She felt relatively well. You know, the first thing you're always thinking about in the context of targeted therapy resistance is it multifocal progression or is it a single-sided progression? In this patient, it was multifocal progression, so I had to think about a new systemic therapy. Now, I think a lot of times I'd like to get a biopsy of a patient and try to look for secondary mechanism resistance. Can I target meta-amplification, something like that? I wasn't able to get a biopsy in this particular patient. She was a little reluctant to proceed with that, and so I had to try to think of a treatment option without biopsy at this point.
So her liquid was negative?
Correct. She just had the underlying EGFR exon 19 deletion.
Yeah. So assuming I'm just kind of curious how you would handle this. Let's assume patritumab were available. Is this a patritumab type patient?
I think so. I think the patient has progressed on proven therapies and patritumab would be a good option. We also heard about chemo amivantamab, but this patient already has had chemotherapy, so patritumab would be a good choice.
So what's the follow-up, Greg?
Yeah, so this patient actually did enroll in one of the patritumab trials, and she's been on patritumab now for about 8 months.
How's she doing? And also tolerability-wise, how's she doing?
She's doing great. She had a partial response. She's had a continued partial response. In terms of tolerability, a little bit of nausea, a little bit of neuropathy, and maybe not typical, but she's had some significant hair loss. And, you know, that's always one of those things in early stage trials, trying to find all the toxicities. Sometimes we discover new toxicities, and that was her tox.
All right, let's finish out with Greg's 44-year-old man with EML4-ALK fusion, who I guess got first-line alectinib. I won't ask you what you would treat today or what you're going to treat tomorrow after we heard about NVL-655. but he did have a progressive disease. Still has ALK. What's the follow-up, Greg?
Yeah, so this is a guy who progressed. I tried to do oligo treatment with a little bit of radiation, but he continued progressing after that. And so this guy is actually, I talked to him about lorlatinib or the NVL-655 trial. He's currently going through screening for the NVL-655 trial, and I'll let you know when I know.
Interesting. So thanks to both of you. Actually, somebody in the chat room, Edgardo Santos, says, great presentation, Greg and Ram. Dr. Love, thank you for bringing these two giants in lung cancer. I agree completely, I think, after tonight particularly. So audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Suresh. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thank you.
Thank you.